Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by the musical globalizers, Afro Celts. At first blush, you might think Celtic and African music are about as far apart rhythmically and harmonically as they are geographically. Think about the pipe and fiddle-heavy chieftains juxtaposed against the tribal beats of the West African talking drums. But on closer inspection, Simon Emerson, guitarist of the group Afro Celts, came to believe that the two musics may have an ancient link. After all, some believe that nomadic Celts lived in Africa and India before they migrated to Spain, France, and the British Isles. The Roman historian Tacitus once wrote about black Celts with dark complexion and unusually curly hair. Emerson ran with the idea and married the two musics with the group Afro-Celt Sound System. Afro-Celt united Celtic pipes and whistles with West African harps and drums and fused them with infectious dance grooves. Since the first album in 1995, the group has broadened its musical repertoire, finding fusion points of Celtic music with Punjab and Latin music. And with their latest album, Seed, coming out at the end of this month, they've dropped the Sound System moniker and changed their name to simply Afro Celts. Said that everybody's a little bit Irish on St. Patrick's Day, and tonight, in preparation for the Day of Green, we're uniting Ireland with the world musically with Afro Celts. Joining me from their studio in London are two members of the Afro Celts, guitarist Simon Emerson and James McNally, who plays everything from keyboards to whistles to the Gaelic drum, the baran, for the group. Welcome, Simon Emerson and James McNally.
Hi, it's very nice to be here.
It's great to have you. So we're listening right now to a cut off the new album coming out, Seed. You've got a new name for the group and a new kind of twist on the sound here. What's the step forward, Simon?
Well, when we started, we were a very sort of broad-based bunch of musicians and artists and people working in multimedia, hence the sound system. We didn't have a drummer and bass player. The concept of the sound system came from bands like Massive Attack and even Left Field and Underworld, and the original reggae gigs that I used to go to as a kid when you'd see a DJ with people performing on top. But that was back in 95. Since then, we've become a band. We've got a stable line up, and on this album, we suddenly realised in the process of making it that we've got a generic sound called the Afro Celts. So we kind of dropped the sound system, and when we come back to America, you'll be seeing a drummer and a bass player. You'll be seeing a real band with a live rhythm section. So that was really the evolution of the band, the name change.
So the group really came on the scene in the 90s when lots of people were sampling and using computers and the turntable to mix a lot of things together. And now you're saying you're evolving into more of a traditional band format.
Yeah, when we started back in the early 90s, when the idea took seed, if you like, it was a radical concept to mix up beats and grooves and world music. It was something that a few bands were doing, like Transglobal Underground and Fundamental and Luke Grew, and we were very much part of that cutting-edge scene. It's become quite commonplace now, which is fine. What's exciting, I think, about this record is you're hearing the sound of a band, of a group, of a bunch of musicians who've been on the road since 95 for 7 years, and we've got an empathy and we've got a sort of band aesthetic and a band style which is uniquely our own, and we're proud of that, and we really want to celebrate that. The discussion about whether Celtic music and African music works together is something that's a bit passé now. We know that works, we've done it, we've established that as a principle, and I think even the argument about whether roots music works with beats and grooves is an argument that even purists no longer have now. So those are two discussions that, if you like, have been put on the back burner. What we're interested in now is taking our music forward as a band, not as a collective, not as a concept, not as a kind of discussion for world music journalists, but very much a bunch of musicians who get on well, play together, and have kind of got a group identity. And you can call that a sort of established band, but, I mean, to be honest, there are very few bands left anymore in Britain, and there seems to be a lot of DJs and a lot of dance collectives, but, you know, the old-style bands are sort of going out of fashion, I think, a bit.
Because so many things are melded together these days in the music. Simon Emerson, I want to listen back for a moment so that we can compare where you've been and where you're going now with the new album Seed. I want to listen to a cut from your CD, Volume 2, Release, and this is Lovers of Light. Let's just listen for a moment. James McNally, here's that distinctly, immediately identifiable techno sound from an earlier album. What was going on with the band and the scene at that time that made this the heart of your sound? And how do you describe the evolution from this to where your new album goes, Seed?
Well, that was a track from our second album where we were sort of like still coming to terms with balancing our Celtic and African sounds together along with the electronica. And it was indeed, speak personally here, it was the electronica that really sort of drew me in. I wanted to experiment with the sounds that I grew up with and the instrumentation I grew up with. Lovers of Light was a very good example there. Illan Pipes, which is it's more or less like the Irish bagpipes, but it's played with the elbow, hence the word Illan. So it's one of the hardest and sort of oldest traditional Irish instruments around, and you'll hear whistles and along with it. But it's the way it interacts with the techno sounds, which, I mean, that album came out around 98, I think it was. So we've moved on quite considerably since then. We'd sort of really became experts at sort of creating these tunes and developing them around the electronica, trying to find the balance between the traditional side of us and the electronic side.
James McNally, give us a sense of where you come to this music from. You're, I think, second generation Irish family, but in London. Did you grow up with Irish music?
I did. I grew up with Irish music, yeah, in London. And it was quite different from the Irish music that was probably played in Ireland. It had a sort of hybrid sort of sections in it. I mean, that's what gave me a great feeling that I could participate quite well in this band, because I was like a bridge between the pure, the sort of history where Ayla, our singer, came from, and the London scene and the beats and grooves. I was very interested in it. I was in a hip-hop group and the Pogues at that time, and both those groups were experimenting with traditional instruments and sort of older cultures and using modern technology. So the Afro-Celts was like a lease of life for me. You know, I finally came home when I got involved with this group.
London's such a diverse ethnic culture today, it may be inevitable that a musician there is going to end up melding.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a fantastic melting pot of cultures here, but it also makes it very hard to actually be heard, because there's so much going on, and there's so many new bands cropping up and experimenting and things. But to be one of the pioneers of what we were trying to do with world music is a great achievement, and we feel very proud of where we stand in our development. And London, I don't think we could have been born in any other city, really.
But I'm reading here that you were an All-Ireland champion early on, but on which instruments? You play several.
Yeah, I was All-Ireland champion on, firstly, the accordion, and then piano, and then the baron, which is the Irish traditional drum. And it was, in fact, it's a very important drum to the whole makeup of the Afrocelt sound. When I first joined the group, when we went down to the Real World Recording Week in 95, it was the connection between the baron and the talking drum that really made me feel there was a journey and an education to be had here by being involved with this.
Describe that connection for us, James McNally. How do you hear it? How did you first feel it?
You know, it was my first language. It sort of came home to me there. I was playing with some musicians that I couldn't speak to vocally. I didn't understand what they were saying. So the language barriers and the cultures were certainly a barrier with that sense. But when we started playing music, it seemed to break down all of that, and we seemed to be connected. We seemed to understand each other. And I more or less saw, you know, without sounding too dramatic, I saw a light opening in my world. Made me feel it opened up the world for me. I wasn't so much confined to either London or to the Irish music that I was brought up with. Suddenly the horizon lifted before me, you know.
So for you, it was really a musical connection. Does it matter to you whether or not any of this history or legend is true about some Irish migrating, all over the world through India, Africa, and up to the islands, or is it just the current connection that counts?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the Irish were great travellers. I mean, a lot of them were forced to leave, you know, the hardships of the country. But you'll find them everywhere. But there is a system where, you know, when the Irish go to America or they go to Australia, they still remain in their clusters, they remain in their clumps, in their sort of, you know, neighbourhoods, an Irish neighbourhood or something. What the Afrocelts was doing to extend that was breaking out and actually communicating with the neighbourhood next door, making the neighbourhood a bigger neighbourhood, you know, that a lot more people could share and belong to. It wasn't just staying in an Irish sort of situation wherever you went. I wanted to break free of that.
And what's the reception to that being in Ireland itself? You must be very aware of that.
Well, over the past few years, we did have a lot of difficulty in proving, or not really proving to people, but people to understand where we were coming from. We felt that, you know, we would go to Ireland, but we weren't quite at home because we weren't 100%. And, you know, in London and in Africa and most of the world. So our best territories are where there is a huge multicultural society already sort of existing. And we don't fear it or experience it as much these days because I think we've gone beyond the conceptual thing. We've proved something both to us and to a lot of people, I think.
When everybody's up and dancing, they may not care where the music came from.
No. I think when they see our concerts and they see the musicians and the cultures and all the things that visually and orally that they experience and they see them blending in and making a sound that is unique and it's sort of like really successful. I think they think about the world themselves, hopefully.
James McNally, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Simon Emerson and James McNally from Afrocelts. Let's go into a break with The Other Side from their new album, Seed. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are approaching St. Patrick's Day tonight with a twist on traditional Irish music, the world sound of Afro-Celts. They've blended African rhythms, traditional Irish sound, and now a whole lot more in their new album Seed, coming out later this month. I'm joined tonight from the group in London by James McNally and Simon Emerson. We're hearing here from the new album Seed, Ayub Song. Simon Emerson, talk to us about what we're hearing in this cut.
This song is the first time we've done a truly acoustic track. It starts with an instrument called a niatiti, which is a Kenyan lyre. It's a small African harp played by a musician called Ayub Agada. We recorded him back in 1995 at the first real-world Afro-Celt recording session, and we had it lying around for years. I guess we felt we were ready to tackle an acoustic track, so I started jamming around it on guitar, and Ila came in and laid some vocals down, and we felt that there was an identity, a purity, and if you like, almost an innocence to the track that didn't need to be covered with slamming beats and programmed synthesizers. What then happened in true Afro-Celt style was we did the sort of passing the baton, and James then picked up on the story of the track and took the African 3-4 rhythm and developed into a 6-8 jig rhythm and incorporated a tune that he wrote when he was 16. One of the first tunes he wrote, which is one of my favourite Afro-Celt tunes ever. And it's a track we're very proud of because I think it takes a while for a band to be able to strip everything down and stand there in our kind of pure form and play the music that comes from our respective roots. And it's the first time we've done anything that's truly acoustic, and I think it works. I think it's a true representation, if you like, of the kind of roots West African tradition and the roots Irish tradition that James is talking about.
Sung in Gaelic, and I read that we have Kenyan chant in the background. We talked with James some about the rhythms and how they meld. What about just simply languages? Have you found that Gaelic flows well together with the sampling and the singing that you brought in from African languages?
Sure, yeah. The languages is actually Mandinka, sung by Nafali, our kora player. Similar, it's one of the oldest languages of West Africa. It goes back to the time when there was a West African kingdom, the Mandinka kingdom, and Nafali's ancestors would have been the bards of West Africa. They called themselves the Griots, and they sang at weddings, and they sang at funerals and at wakes, and they sang the oral tradition of the nobility. And in that sense, they were very close to the Celtic bards. And what's interesting here is that Ila is a direct descendant from the Celtic bards. He sings the Shanoz tradition, the unaccompanied tradition, that is one of the oldest vocal traditions in Europe. So in a way, from an ethnomusicological point of view, although I hate using that term, you've got the link there. You've got the link between the West African Mandinka kingdom and the time when, you know, the Celts had a very strong cultural and political tradition in Europe. What's interesting is when you reinvent it, and I guess we've waited for 7 years to find a way of doing it that is natural and organic to ourselves as musicians. What I think is remarkable about that tune and the following tune is Nafali's chorus playing, actually, because when he takes a chorus solo in the middle of As You Were, you just feel that he is playing a music that he deeply understands and is deeply within his own musical tradition. So I think the music really does speak for itself there.
Simon Emerson, you made your first U.S. tour in 1999. You were on the David Letterman show with Peter Gabriel and the cut When You're Falling. I want to hear about the reception you got in the U.S., but let's hear first just a little bit of that track. This is Afro-Celts with Peter Gabriel, the tune When You're Falling, from the CD Further in Time.
Every day you crawl into the night, a fallen angel with your wings set in light. When you hit the ground, everything turns to blue.
Simon Emerson, there you are with Peter Gabriel. We know that Sinead O'Connor has played a role in your band's evolution. You've toured with the Dave Matthews Band. Your Afro-Celts are featured on the Oscar-nominated Martin Scorsese film Gangs of New York. How do all these links come together for Afro-Celts?
Well, you tell me. When we played in L.A. for the first time at the House of Blues, the audience was full of the LA film industry, and Lawrence Fishburne was hanging around waiting for us in the dressing room, which was a spook. Harvey Keitel was there, and I think they like us. I mean, we've always said our music is written to an imaginary film score. Our music is very, it takes you on a voyage. It's very, we deal in landscapes. We're an evocative band. We quite often write tracks with a sort of musical landscape in mind or a concept. For example, the opening track on the album, Siberia, starts off very cold and icy and wet and rainy. And then by the time Jesse Cook, flamenco guitarist, kicks in, it's gone sort of warm and hot and Iberian, if you like. It goes from Siberia to Iberia. That's a classical Afro-Celt journey. The track Falling that you've just played is the complete opposite of that. We sat down and we put our record producer's hat on and we went, right, let's write a pop song. Let's do it in 4 minutes. Let's try and make our point, have the middle eight where it should be. And, you know, we're not ashamed of pop music. There's a folk tradition in Britain that's pop music, if you like. You know, it goes back to Lennon and McCartney. And we set ourselves a challenge. James came up with the initial concept. We worked on it. I just brought a mandolin, the first bit of mandolin playing I'd ever done in a recording studio. And to cut a long story short, to our amazement, Peter Gabriel agreed to sing it. And the next thing we knew, it was a AAA radio hit in America. And we were very, very proud of that. And we were kind of celebrated in America for having the success. It's a very different story over here in England.
What about your overall reception in the U.S.? We know that the entertainment industry really swooned for you, maybe off of that House of Blues performance in Los Angeles, talking about all the places you've appeared, and I guess your music has often been on Sex and the City as well. But what about the crowds? Who comes out for an Afro-Celts performance? Is it a large Irish audience? Is it right across the board? Is it in clubs and a techno scene? And what's the American ethnic Irish response to Afro-Celts?
Well, it's different for every gig. It's a movable feast. Every gig we do, there's a different crowd. We've had some amazing cross-cultural experiences. When we played in Detroit, we played in a downtown hip-hop club, and the American Irish came out, the old guys, and they were amazed. They were saying, you know, why are you playing here? And, you know, and it was good. I mean, by the end of the gig, a rap crew got up and were on stage with us, singing about, you know, Afro-American Irish unity, and the whole crowd were there with us. And, you know, we bring people together. The first gig we did, which really celebrated that for me, was Summer Stage in New York. And you looked out and you could see the American Irish and the Afro-American. You could see people, the Indian community had come to see Talvin sing and Johnny Kelsey played. And it was amazing. There's a point in the set where we stop the beats and James does a Baron solo and Musa does a talking drum solo and they interact. And in a way, as James said earlier on, that's the language that brings people together. Music is a universal language. And when you see two musicians with that kind of degree of integrity and skill playing off each other and sparring, it's a joyful experience. We're still trying to work out an American crowd, to be honest. You know, sometimes we get techno kids. Sometimes we get a much older audience, people in their 50s. We're still working at it. I suspect if we start playing Afro-Celt in concert tours in seated venues, we'll probably get a bigger audience.
James McNally, let me just ask you on that same front. You know, of course, that the Irish-American community and African-American community have, by economics and attitude and for all kinds of reasons, often come into conflict in the United States. Do you see them, can you see them in one big audience at an Afro-Celt concert?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're still relatively newcomers to the scene over in the States, playing-wise, to the Irish community and also to the African community, because it took a while for them to realize that we're part of them. I mean, our first experiences were, like Simon was saying, was to all-comers, really, and they were very curious about our music. I mean, it was being played an awful lot on the television and radios and advertisements, and there was, and even like Dave Matthews asked us personally to play on part of his support tour in the States, and his audience really opened up to us. I mean, we played Montreal jazz festivals, we played the Summer Stage, we played Irish festivals, we played rock festivals. There doesn't seem to be a festival, although they're all in categories, and the thing about America is I do think it sticks to its categories, and anyone that sort of crosses any of them finds it a little bit tougher to allow people to understand that, you know, we're not one thing or the other. We're a new thing.
It means you're breaking new ground. I want to listen to the track that was in Gangs of New York, Dark Moon, High Tide, off your first CD, Sound Magic. But before we do, can you, you must have seen the film at this point. What's the scene that this music lies behind in Gangs of New York?
Well, it crops up several times, actually. It's not just one scene. But it's particularly where Leonardo DiCaprio, that's your man.
Yes.
Yeah, he's sort of looking for to kill some man.
But do you have a sense? I mean, we can hear the sense of menace that this could well support in a movie.
Yeah, I mean, Dark Moon, High Tide was a track that we wanted to evoke the darkness and the mystery within the kind of Celtic tradition. You know, we tend to get lumped in with the kind of rather fluffy New Age acts, and it's not really what we're about at all. There's a whole side to the Afro-Celts, which I think has a darkness, often a sense of melancholy, a sense of longing and yearning, and that is very strong in Celtic music, and it's very strong in Irish music. It's strong in all traditional music, where the native people have left their country, basically, and have travelled and have set up home elsewhere. You get it in the Portuguese fado tradition, and it's something you can hear in James's whistle playing, in Ema's pipe playing. I mean, that was actually Davy Splann, our original piper, but, you know, we've taken that song on quite a lot. It was great, though. It was great to get it picked up I think it was Scorsese himself, actually, who picked up on it originally.
Dark Moon, High Tide. Of course, the Irish immigrants in New York play such a major role in Gangs of New York, and there we hear that sort of your fusion works so well with the Irish sound in the background, but then this beat that, to my ear, also says something about the new world, about America. That may be another kind of natural fusion point where African and Irish mix and meet.
Yeah, I mean, the politics and the sociology of the Afro-Celts go back over the last 100 years. All the London Irish communities were, you know, the working class communities where you had Asians and you had Africans and you had Irish living together. It's something that's been commented on a lot. You know, in the 50s, the race riots in London, in Notting Hill, you had black people and Irish people fighting side by side against the racists because they were both considered, you know, part of an alien immigrant culture, if you like. And I don't want to get too political here, but, you know, we get very well received by the Irish when we're over there. I think they feel that, you know, there's a sense of solidarity, global solidarity in our music that gives people hope.
Simon Emerson, James McNally, stand by. We're talking tonight with members of the group Afro-Celts. Let's go into a short break with Siberia. This is a combination of Gaelic singing, Mandinka samples, and a flamenco beat. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We are enjoying the music tonight of Afro-Celts. This is Rise Above from their new album, Seed. St. Patrick's Day is Monday, but we've got the whole thing going on already. We're joined tonight from London by Simon Emerson and James McNally from the group Afro-Celts. Simon, when we see Afro-Celts on stage, what do we see? Who's up there? Who's playing what?
Well, you see a big band. At times it's been 9-10 people. Prior to this, I said we were a sound system, which is a concept that Americans aren't familiar with, but there would have been a lot of MIDI gear, you know, the modern equivalent of DJ decks. There's a kora player and a balafon player called Nafali, talking drum player, Johnny Kelsey, who plays the Indian dole drum, another percussion player, James playing baron and whistle and keyboards, myself, Ila, Ema on pipes, I can go on. What we will be bringing back to America is that concept with a drummer and bass player. So you'll be seeing a band, not a sound system.
But it's very much a combination of African musicians and musicians from England and Ireland.
Absolutely. You have on stage some of the oldest instruments in the world, such as the djembe and talking drums and baron, ilan pipes. You have instruments that represent some of the oldest traditions in the world, and you also have musicians playing some of the most modern cutting-edge music in the world in terms of kind of contemporary dance music, drum and bass, garage beats and techno.
James, I just wanted to ask how important techno in the 90s was as a kind of, I don't know, dissolving solution that with its big, big, insistent beat allowed all this to merge together. Was techno the envelope that was critical to your sound emerging?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think all the members of the band, the African guys and the Irish guys, wanted to, I mean, that was the first initial language. It's probably the, you know, the traditional music of the future. It will be one of them anyway when you, in 50 years' time, you'll look back and think, oh, you remember techno. Wasn't that fantastic? But we like to bring our cultures and ancient traditions. We have to balance it with what's happening today and hopefully what's happening, you know, trying to be a little bit forward-looking into the future to connect with the young people of today. Because in many ways, a lot of people, when we first started, were afraid that we were sort of diluting the cultures and traditions, when in fact the members of the band and they were deeply immersed in their traditions, and they should have been, you know, their opinions should have been respected really, and to much extent it was, when they were saying that what they were doing was almost like trying to prolong and keep their culture alive. I mean, certainly Ila has sung in more countries in the world than he would have ever had he stuck to his own village and his own scene. He's appeared in all the countries and they've heard Shenos, and he's connected and he's brought the Gaelic language to a lot more people that could have ever hoped to. And indeed the young people that, you know, need to see these things, need to see these instruments and cultures and see people get on together.
And what about in Ireland, James McNally? Have you toured there? What's your reception been?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And in fact, most of our African members are dearly loved over there. They, you know, a lot of the Irish fans are very, very supportive of us, and they've been inspired to sort of like start groups themselves and sort of mix up the cultures and delve in the electronica. I think we've broken down boundaries of fear where people used to think it could be destroyed. Certain things were, you know, of course there are groups which don't do it as successfully, but it is very hard to keep a group that has so many people from all over the world together.
What about the rhythms themselves, James? On the baron, you know it well. That traditional Irish rhythm, does it match a traditional African rhythm or simply coexist well with it?
It's basically in how you play the instrument. I mean, the drums are played by the baron, which is the traditional Irish drum, is played either by the hand or the stick or various sticks. And it's done in a certain way that allows a certain sound to come out, and by developing it, you know, coming across a talking drum or a djembe or the various other drums, the dole drum, you do have to find common ground, common language. You have to search. It doesn't just happen. There are certain beats and rhythms that don't allow sort of sharing, and I mean the baron was originally just to be the solo drum. There was no other drums involved, and it's so busy, the normal playing of the baron to back to traditional music is so busy, it doesn't allow anything in. So you have to develop a style and work with the rhythms. But when you find that common goal, it really is illuminating and enlightening.
Well, there's a metaphor for cultures working together, some opening up and airing of that traditional rhythm that allows all the drums to mingle.
That's right. I mean, we're all sort of steeped in tradition, and we love the old culture and we honour it, but we're looking for a way into the future to keep it together and maybe form another language, a new language. I mean, when Ila sings Gaelic and Nephali sings Mandinka, none of us here cannot see the pictures they're painting. It's a language that we feel we understand, and when we write music together, we're looking for the path to enlightenment, to give us a way ahead that we don't feel we're going to lose anything. Break down the barriers of fear, really.
James McNally, I want to thank you and Simon Emerson so much for joining us tonight. It's just been great. Thank you very much for joining us from there in London.
No problem. We look forward to coming to the States very soon and showing you what we've been talking about.
Wonderful to have you on. Afro Celts' new album, Seed, will be released in the United States on March 25th. They hope to be touring in the U.S. this summer. Keep your eye out. Details at our website, onpointradio.org. We're going to go out with the cut Green Instrumental from the new album, Seed. Happy St. Paddy's Day when it comes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Each of these tests is demanding, but eminently deliverable. Now, these tests are not traps. They're six sets of tests drawn from 29 different clusters with more than 100 tests, actually set out in the 173-page document published by Dr. Blix at the end of the Security Council meeting last Friday.
The British put it down yesterday as a way to be helpful, to see if there was a way to move forward. Instantly, one member of the council, one of the permanent members, dismissed it out of hand and said they'll veto anyway. They're going to veto anything, any language, anything that comes along, they said they would veto.
To be a credible and responsible partner, the new Palestinian prime minister must hold a position of real authority. We expect that such a Palestinian prime minister will be confirmed soon.
That's catastrophe, global catastrophe for the Serbian people, for Mr. Ginger's family, for transformations from every changes in Serbia. Catastrophe. I'm very afraid.
It is that notion of collective guilt which is the true enemy of peace, since it encourages communities to nurture hatred against each other from one generation to the next.
With this Senate vote, I'm more confident than ever that we will soon reach the day when the president can sign a ban on partial birth abortion, relegating this horrific procedure to a sad chapter in our nation's history.
What a great day for the state of Utah, right? Darn right. Up there in that interview room, you've got a boatload of officers. You can't wipe the smiles off their face. They're so excited to have her back.
And there's a week, a British twist of six new demands on Saddam goes nowhere. A frustrated Colin Powell blasts France for continuing to threaten a veto of any resolution authorizing war against Iraq. President Bush today offers a timetable for a roadmap, or at least conditions, to peace in the Middle East. Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic is assassinated in Belgrade. Kofi Annan hails the formal opening of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Representative Steve Chabot praises the Senate for passing a ban on partial birth abortions. And Utah police and the whole country rejoice as missing teenager Elizabeth Smart is found alive 9 months after her abduction. There's a week, Jack.
Yes, and, I think crucial to the what's been going on in the Security Council is the question of timing. The Chileans today tried to get the U.S. to agree to a 30-day window on inspections. No, said the U.S. The French had even talked about something longer than that. And the question is why? Why the rush? And I think the dynamics of U.S. policy today point us to a possible and frightening answer. I think if you look at the signs, the administration, what have they done here? They have just said inspections will not work. UN-sponsored inspections will not work as a non-proliferation device. We just don't believe in that. Well, what country out there is going to need some of these in order to verify its nuclear program? North Korea. We know something about North Korea. Within the next couple of months, it is going to be producing, mass producing almost, nuclear weapons. We can't allow that. and Bush will not talk to them directly as they want to. That leaves only one road, a preemptive strike. And I think the timing here is to get the Iraq thing over as quickly as they can and then shift focus toward a preemptive strike against the North Korean nuclear plant and possibly the North Korean artillery emplacements. There have been signs of this. Richard Armitage, the Assistant Secretary of State, told Congress, I saw the testimony, we're going to talk directly with North Korea. The president apparently went up the wall over that. So that's ruled out. Rumsfeld last week talked about redeploying U.S. forces in South Korea. What does that mean? That means moving them back for the DMZ where they will be out of harm's way if the war, the North Koreans respond.
So, Jack, you're not reading this as putting pressure on the North Koreans, but actually as potentially clearing the way for a military preemptive strike there.
I think so. I mean, our doctrine is preemptive strikes. We will not talk to them directly. They say that's their bottom line. They're going to be producing weapons. We can't allow that. That leaves only one out. We have the doctrine. And I think that the haste here is to get Iraq done and get right on to a strike on North Korea.
Well, it's a hunch, but it might fit into this picture. But, oh, what a risk to South Korea. And then, of course, there is Iraq, where everybody in the world is now on the edge of their chair, kind of on hold, wondering what's next. The president, Tony Blair, will be hunkered down in the Azores over the weekend as a last stab at diplomatic progress, but there's no one there but themselves and the Spanish leader.
No, we're dead. The coalition of the willing is a pretty slender group. You know, today the L.A. Times had a really important leak, a State Department report called Iraq and the Middle East, No Dominoes. This report by one of the intelligence services in the bureaus in the State Department says that the Bush theory of, you know, a tsunami of democracy following from our invasion of Iraq is nonsense, a fantasy, that the dynamics point the other way toward more repression in the Arab world, toward an arms race with Syria and Iran, and just shoots down this notion, which is the sort of new justification for our policy. The timing couldn't be more embarrassing for the administration.
And this from the U.S. State Department leaked.
From the U.S. State Department, mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Of course, well known that they see the world differently from many of those right around George Bush. What about on the home front, Jack? What are you seeing this week?
I think that the Bush dividend tax cut is dead. Republican moderate senators have come over with the Democrats, enough of them to defeat it. And indeed, the tax cuts look to be about half of what Bush wanted. That may be a good thing for the economy if Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner, is right. He said recently that the Bush dividend tax cut was a trifecta. It wouldn't stimulate the economy. It would worsen our long-range financial situation, and it would worsen inequality.
And yet, Bush said from the beginning, half a loaf might be better than none. He wanted to start out big. That may be what he gets, half a loaf here.
He may indeed. The marriage penalty tax cut and a few other things, maybe even some things that would stimulate the economy. Lord knows it needs it.
Yeah, I guess this week that looks like the case. Jack, thanks so much for being with us tonight. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.